Hello and welcome to A Responsible Day for the 13th day of Tishrei. Today we're going to see a couple of tshuvot, probably three, but one of them very briefly, by the Chatam Sofer from the 13th of Tishrei. I always find it interesting when you find multiple tshuvot by the same meshiv, the same respondent, on a particular day, because it's sort of, it's like a snapshot of his life, a very small snapshot, but a snapshot of his life. Let's remember to thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hachhauser, for their assistance in putting these shiurim online. And let's jump right into Shut Chatam Sofer. This is going to be the first one, Chelek Bet, the second volume, the Eruday section, Siman Resh Mem Vav, response of 246. And this is from the 13th of Tishrei of Tuf Kuf Pei Dalet. And then we're going to do another tshuva also from Tuf Kuf Pei Dalet. So that's also interesting to me when you have two tshuvot written on the same exact day that appear in the Sefer Tshuvot, but are not in the same tshuva. They're two separate tshuvot written on this day. So the first one, it's about the case of a man who's a moel. The man is a certified circumciser, right? He circumcises babies. And a man in his area had a son, and he contacted him, and he said, I'd like you to be the moel, which is considered to be an honor, and I think it also was somewhat financially remunerative. So he asked him to be the moel, and they shook hands on it. And as they did, this moel, this certified circumciser, checked, and he said, I want to shake hands on this because I know that you have a chevrata sandiko, you have like a fellowship in your town of people who perform brit milah and who want to be the sandik, who want to have the honors at various brisin. And I live far, now whatever defined as far, meaning in those days, this is in Tuf Kuf Pei Dalet, which is 1823, so it might be meaning he had to go by horse, he had to walk 5 miles, whatever far means, but it was far. And he said, I want to check with you. And the guy said, yes, and they shook hands on it. Comes on the day of the Brit Milah, he comes on the day of the circumcision, and in fact, now the way he says it, I think is very nice. In the question, they say, V'omnam Baal HaBrit, Eino Ne'eman Bivrito. So Baal HaBrit means the father of the baby who needs the Brit Milah, the circumcision, and Baal HaBrit is also somebody who's entered into a pact. And he says, the Baal HaBrit, the man who entered into the pact, Eino Ne'eman Bivrito, did not stick with the agreement that he had made. In fact, he had already given over the right to be mohel, the son, to circumcise the son, to this chevrat hasandiko, to these people who had this union, as it were, with this group who do these things. And this mohel comes from far. He's upset, A, that he didn't get a chance to perform this mitzvah. He's upset, B, that he put into all this effort to come. And he's upset, C, that he's embarrassed because he comes to the town and everybody knows that he's a moel. He comes to the town and now the guy's ignoring him and giving it to somebody else. So in the town, and this is sort of an insight, the Chasam Sofer is going to protest this, but in the town, there's, or a city for all that I know, one of the local rabbi types jumps up and he says, you know what, I can figure this out. We'll get three people to serve as sort of a beit din. And then they will do like a hatarat nedarim, right? If somebody makes a neder, if somebody makes a vow or an oath, and then they realize that they can't keep it, and for some reason, they can go to a beit din, and they can, under certain circumstances, be matir the neder. So this rabbi type says, we can do this for the father, and we can be matir the tkiat kaf, the handshake that he gave, the commitment that he gave. We can say, oh, he didn't realize X or Y or Z, and therefore that handshake should not count as a handshake anymore, and then we won't have any problem, and this moel won't have any claims against him. That's what he suggested. So the Chasam Sofer says, the Mordechai in Kol HaGet, in the Perek in Bava Basra, says, first of all, when you make a verbal commitment, you can't just go back, Hatarat Nedarim is when I make a personal vow that applies to me personally. There I can do a Hatarat Nedarim. But when I make a personal commitment, even just orally, just verbally, Mordechai says, you can't just go back on that. And you can't, what's called the Mechusar Amanah, somebody who's not trustworthy, somebody who doesn't stick to their word. And you're not part of, or you don't count among, so this is a pasuk in Tzifanya, Gimel Yud Gimel 3:13. I think it's an important pasuk that people don't always remember. She'erit Yisrael lo yasu avlav lo yedabru chazab. The Jewish people, the remnants of the Jewish people, those of us who have survived all throughout Jewish history, are not those, Tzfanya says, who do things wrong and who speak falsely, who speak and don't keep what they speak. I mean, it's supposed to be one of the identifying characteristics of a Jew that their word is what they stick to. And if this person decides that he can go back on his word, even if he finds a bait to tell him that it's okay, so the Mordechai says, no, that doesn't get you, can't do that. So that would seem to be a problem. The Taz does say, however, in Shulchan Aruch, in Yeridei Siman Reish Samach Dalet, that if in the interim the father finds it better than Moel. So what's better and worse than a Moel? There's things like how long it takes you to do it, how much pain you cause the baby, how successful you tend to be in terms of not having to go back and fix up things that you missed on the way in, how well the baby's recovered. There's all sorts of ways you can judge how good a Moel is. So if in the interim you find a better Moel and you hadn't realized, lo'osik adate, you hadn't realized you might find that Moel, so then this aspect of having to stick to your verbal commitments doesn't apply. That's what the Taz says, meaning when we make commitments, and this is more similar to a nether, when you make a commitment or you make a vow, you make an oath, it's with a certain set of expectations. But if another expectation, if something else happens that you couldn't have expected, so the Taz says in the case of Moel, so let's say, for example, let's say, you know, in my neighborhood, there's a famous Moel. I'm not going to say any names, but there's a famous Moel. Let's suppose you thought you couldn't get him, so you hired somebody else, and then it turned out in between that you could get him. And you wanted this famous Moel, so well known, to be a great Moel. So there the Taz says the breaking of that commitment doesn't count as the kind of breaking a commitment that violates the verse in Zephaniah. And the Taz thinks even if you swore to do something in that situation, you can be matir the shvua based on that, based on saying that I found this new world that I never had expected I could get. So if that's true, that would be maybe relevant, except that in our case, the Moel knew that there was a local chivrat sanekud fellowship of people who do milah and who want to be part of circumcision ceremonies. And he said to him, I don't want to make this agreement with you because I'm worried that you're going to hire one of them. You're going to take one of them to do the milah. And the man said no, and they shook hands on it. So therefore, the Taz doesn't fit. And therefore, the man, the father, just seems to have violated his word, to have broken his word, because he made a commitment and there was no new information that would allow us to think of the Taz's scenario as being relevant. Not only that, shaking hands according to the Chazal Sefer, shaking hands according to the most, according to the important Rishonim, counts as a kritut brit. It's like making a covenant, not just making an oath or a commitment. There's verbal commitment, there's oath, and then there's a tkiat kaf, which is like a kritat brit. It's like making an actual pact, and then it's not so simple to be matir that pact and to just get rid of it. Not only that, what's even worse is that if the father changed his mind, let's say the baby is born, let's say the day after the baby is born, the father spoke to this Moel. That leaves a week or 6 days in which he changed his mind. So he changed his mind. So if the day before, 2 days before, he had contacted that Moel, he'd gone himself or sent somebody, he contacted that Moel and said, listen, I changed my mind, that would be a whole different thing because he wouldn't have caused the Moel, first of all, the expense of coming and the waste of time of coming. And for all we know, it could be the Moel had another job that day that he gave up for this job. But in any case, but he cost him stuff. So there's damage here. And the Chatam Sofer points out, there's a Gemara Bava Kama on Lamed Amud Aleph, which says, Chayman Debay the Mehavei Chasid, if somebody wants to be a particularly careful and punctilious Jew, one of the options is given there is to be very careful about leading Ezekiel, about damaging other people. There's other options in that Gemara, but that this is one that's relevant here, meaning this man is causing the moral damage for no good reason. And therefore, the truth is, even if something new had come along, a better Moel, right, who he didn't know about beforehand, he had made such a, the shaking of hands was should have meant that he couldn't change his mind anyway, because it's more like a kritat brit than an oath. And even if he had decided that he was going to and even if the Moel, even the Moel lived here, so it wouldn't have been a far travel, but he just didn't tell him, and he causes him this embarrassment. That's itself terrible, because embarrassing other people is a terrible thing. And therefore, that Taz cannot be a source of help to this man, to the father. The father just did a terrible thing, and the person who told the father, you know what, we can just put together a bait and get rid of the kid for the handshake, is one of these people who's ghastly bobo ra'ah, who's ruling on halachic issues when he really doesn't have the right to. So that's the first of our tshuvot from the 13th of Tishrei about a failed commitment, right? The commitment was made to the Moel, then it was changed when it shouldn't have been, and that's what it's about. The second tshuva from that same day, which is in a later volume, Shulchan Aruch Silver, Volume Dalet, Volume 4, the Evin Ezer section, response number 74, is about a woman, and this comes up periodically in Jewish history. It's an unfortunate thing, but it's a reminder, I think, that there are more Jews who were lost to Judaism over the course of history by virtue of converting out than we tend to think of. We today think of like abandoning religion or converting to another religion as sort of a new phenomenon. Unfortunately and sadly, it's not true. So this is an example of a woman whose husband died, passed away without their having had children. She therefore should have to have Yibum or Chalitza, but the only brother-in-law is a Mumar. He's somebody who has left the religion. He's left the religion, and he did it after she got married. So when she got married, he had a brother who was an Orthodox from Jew. Then he left the religion, and now we don't know where he is. And then what happened is there's rumors that the brother-in-law passed away. So if he passed away, there's no Yabam, and then she can marry whoever she wants. And then after that, they got a letter, the Chatam Sofer got a letter, that the wife had heard from her nephew, the son of this Mumar, who is an observant Jew, right? The father left the religion, the son did not. He says he heard that his father had died. So the question is, can she rely on these reports? She doesn't have actual witnesses that she died. She has the son, who can't really be a witness, but she has the son who's saying that he knows that he died, and she has the rumors that he died. So the Chatam Sofer says he thinks that with this information, the son counts as an Eidechad. He counts as one witness, and we usually let women get married on the basis of one witness saying that the husband or the potential husband has passed away. Once he's on the topic, though, he says, well, let's talk about the whole status of a woman who's Yabam, whose brother-in-law, who needs a Yibum or a Chalitza, whose brother-in-law is a Mumar, does she need a Chalitza or not? So he knew of a Psak, and he uses Rashi Tevet that I don't know of. Maybe he means Rabbeinu Gershom, I'm not sure. But who holds that even though the brother-in-law is a Mumar, she needs a Chalitza. So the truth is that that's a debate already going back to the time of the Gaonim. Another reminder that there were Mumarim around, there were people who have abandoned the religion around in many, many times in Jewish history. Shri Ragaron seems to have felt that the fact that the guy abandoned the religion, since he was born Jewish, he remains Jewish. That means there is a Jewish Yabam out there, and therefore she has to wait and find a Chalitza. But Yudai Gaon had held that if the brother-in-law left the religion after the marriage, that's when the Yabam became a Mumar, then she doesn't have Chalitza from him. Why not? So we're going to get to that. But he also writes that if the Baal became a Mumar, the husband became a Mumar after the marriage, and she just had to stay with him because she couldn't get divorced because he wouldn't divorce her, and then he dies as a non-observant Jew, and doesn't have any children, there too, Rabbi Yudai Gaon says, he doesn't need a Yibum because the Hailav Achiv, because either one of them, who's a Mumar, doesn't count as a brother. They don't count as a brother because there are psukim elsewhere that say achicha, and that halacha understands it to mean achicha b'mitzvah, somebody who's still with you. But that this is the way Rav Yudai Gaon seems to be understanding it, that it has to be your brother in observance. And if somebody leaves the observance, they're not your brother for many halachic purposes, and therefore they don't need a chalitza. So that's the way the Baal HaItur presents it. Now Rashi, in a tshuva, disagrees, and there's a Tshuvos Maimonios, which is not a Rambam's Tshuva, it's a Tshuvos that are printed in the Rambam's, in the Mishnah Torah, but I think they're not Tshuvos of the Rambam. Well, maybe they are. I think there's somebody else's Tshuvos that are printed there. Maybe they are the Rambam's Tshuvos. Anyway, there too, they held that no, that Afal Pi Shechata Yisrael, that as long as a Jew is alive, he's a Jew. And even if he leaves the religion, so he sinned a lot. And that's a terrible thing, and that has certain halachic ramifications. But they're still a Jew, so there's still a Jewish brother here, and therefore you would need to have a Yibum or a Chalitza. And then they also say, and what's the difference? Why do we care if the if the leaving of the religion happened before or after her marriage? And while they're piling up questions, they're bringing up a question that I think is a really interesting one, because it displays a certain perspective that I'm not sure has to be the actual perspective, although it is a widespread perspective in halakhic literature. He points out there's a Mishnah in Yevamot that says, Mishi yesh lo ach mikol makom, where is a brother anywhere, or any kind of a brother? So the word says, what do you mean by any kind of a brother? Kamar lerabot mamzer, to include a brother who's produced by the father in an illicit relationship. By illicit, I mean that it carries a curried prohibition to it. So that's how you get a mamzer. So to the Chatam Sofer, or whoever he's quoting, he might be quoting Rashi, the Tshuvos Maimonides, it says that shows you mashma sheyeh mi sheyeh afilu mumar, that whoever it is, even if it's a mumar. Now, I would have thought, if I was learning on my own, I'm not, but I would have thought that when the Gemara Yevamot says, even a mamzer, what it means is, you might have thought that since a mamzer is conceived in terrible sin, right, a sin of at least the level of a karet, you might have thought that by virtue of that conception in sin, it doesn't count as a brother, because the Torah just says it doesn't count as a brother. So the Gemara is telling you no, even that. But that's not relevant to the question of if the man is a mumar. If we had a halachic principle that a mumar, somebody who leaves the religion, that leaving of the religion has enough halachic ramifications that he's no longer thought of as our brother in that sense, those aren't really the same thing at all, and therefore I wouldn't have thought to combine them. I think that I've seen this in this source and other sources, that people just see the word mamzer as meaning the worst kind of Jew you can imagine, which is kind of not fair to the mamzer, because I don't think that's actually what the mamzer is. The mamzer has a problematic lineage, and that affects lineage issues, but I'm not sure what it affects other than that. Chatzim Sofer suggests, though, that the reading of Rav Shvira Gaon is that she needs the chalitza is less strict or severe than you might think it is, and he comes to explain the way he understands it. He thinks that the Shvira Gaon is actually worried about the opposite possibility from what we're worried about. It's not that the Mumar brother-in-law has to do a chalitza. Without the chalitza, we can't for here. It's that we might have worried that even a chalitza from the Yabam, from this brother-in-law, wouldn't work. And why would we think it would work? Because we might think to ourselves, well, if he doesn't believe in the religion, then maybe chalitza doesn't count as a chalitza, because he's not doing it as a chalitza. He's doing whatever he wants to do. So maybe the ceremony doesn't count. And therefore, Rav Shvira Gaon, this is the way Chatzim Sofer reads it, Rav Shvira Gaon says, you know what, if he's a mumar, if he's really abandoned the religion, Rav Shvira Gaon agrees with Yehudai Gaon that he's not really counting as a brother, and therefore, she doesn't need Yibum if he's still a Mumar. What are we worried about? We're worried that maybe he thought to himself, you know what, I shouldn't be a Mumar anymore. I shouldn't leave the religion. I should really return to Judaism. So even if he doesn't actually act upon it, once he has that Hirhur Tshuva, once he has that thought that he's not a full Mumar anymore, even if he's still weak and he hasn't managed to get back yet, his status has changed. So we have to worry about that. And therefore, you need a chalitza to cover all of our bases. This is the way Chassid Sofer is understanding the Rav Shvira Gaon. We need the chalitza to cover our bases. How do we cover our bases? If he thought to himself, maybe I should do tshuva, then the chalitza should work, because he's now at least a somewhat penitent Jew, and therefore it should work. And if he didn't ever have such a thought that he wanted to return to Judaism, then we don't have to worry about whether his chalitza works or not, because he doesn't need a yibum, because he doesn't fully count as a Jew. That's how he understands Rav Shvira Gaon. And then, in his mind, that would explain Rav Yehudai Gaon's perspective. Remember that Rav Yehudai Gaon had said, if he was a Mumar at the time of the marriage, so then at the time of the marriage, he had the status of somebody who would not be the kind of person we need a chalitza from. Now, what are we going to say to ourselves? We're going to say to ourselves, but maybe he did tshuva. So Chatzim Sofer says yes, but if when they got married he was that kind of a person, then there was never created an expectation that she would have to have yibum with him. Why would we not have that expectation? Because he is now a mumar who can't do yibum or chalitza, can't effectively do it because he's an observant Jew. It's true the possibility of tshuva is out there, but we don't have to expect it. What changes if he wasn't a mumar at the time of the nisuin? If he wasn't a mumar at the time of the nisuin, then in the marriage there was embedded the expectation that she would, if, God forbid, the husband died without children, she would have to do yibum or chalitza with his brother-in-law. True, he then left the religion, and that means that it's not going to be effective. But when the husband dies, the expectation was still there in that original marriage, and therefore we then have to worry that maybe he did tshuva. That's the way the Chassam of our son says it, meaning he's saying that it depends on what Rav Yehudai Gaon was saying was, it depends on what we expected. If we expected there might be a yibum, then the possibility of tshuva becomes an issue for us. If we never expected that there would be a yibum from the beginning, because that possibility of tshuva is not enough of a doubt to create an expectation of yibum, so then she doesn't have to worry about it. And that's why he said, if he was already a mumar at the time of the marriage, he doesn't have to worry about it. That's the way the Chassam Sofer reads it. There are other ways to read that Rav Yehudai Gaon, but that's enough for us for these purposes. There's a bit more to this tshuva, but I want to get on to this, the third tshuva that I have for the 13th of Tishrei, which is from 11 years later, Tavkuf Tzadi Hei, should have been 1834, but I want to get to it. But I just want to point out that there's a whole discussion among the Rishonim and Achronim about the fact that why would we think this whole category of he's a mumar would affect his ability to do yibum? And so there's all sorts of claims made. So for example, the Tshuva Sedeshin said it's an odd thing to say, because where we see halachically that you're not a long brother, that's for things like returning his lost items to him. There are areas where you say he has to be your brother. Why should that be relevant to the question of and the issue of yibum? So some try to claim that actually when it comes to Yerusha, to inheritance, becoming a mumar gets you out of that group. Becoming a one who leaves the religion gets you out of that group, and then he goes to the Chassam Sofer says, so that's a very strange thing to say, because then you might think to yourself all sorts of things, like, let's say a man has a child, and the child then, God forbid, leaves the religion. Does that mean he has to now find, you know, have a new child who hasn't filled the mitzvah period of Rivia, he hasn't filled the mitzvah of having children, of procreation, and all sorts of questions like that. So it's a complicated issue when people are in Mumar. I think, not that it's in the cause of Sofer here, but I think our general assumption is, in fact, that if the brother-in-law is a Mumar, we use the idea that maybe she doesn't need a chalitza at all to help us in various, if there are difficult situations. We always try to arrange a chalitza if we can, but if not, this kind of thinking, I think, is often used, even in Poskim today, as a snif lahatira, as a help and an aid to being matir, to saying that it's permissible for her to remarry even without a chalitza from this brother-in-law. Now, the last Jew in our group is from the fifth volume of Chatzim Sofer, in the Choshen Mishpat section, Siman Kuf Samech Bet, and it's about a rabbi who has shown himself not to be such a good rabbi. And it raises interesting questions, because the Chatzim Sofer, who I think is known to be like a vigorous battler against reform and things like that, I think is going to be more lenient on some issues than we would have expected him to be. So these are the city leaders of Cheba, which is a town or a city, and they wrote them a letter about their Rav, and they had collected information about this Rav, Rav Yehonatan HaLevi, who's the rabbi in their community, and they got all sorts of reasons to think that he's not a good rabbi, and they want to get rid of him, and they want to know what the halacha is. So he says, first of all, he wants you to know, as a general principle, they accepted testimony not in front of this rabbi type, because he refused to come to court. So the Chazon says, that's good. Yafeh asu, that was fine. And that's din Torah. Why? Because you sent him information. You sent him a summons a few times. He refused to come. Now, he claimed that he was a bigger Torah scholar than the people who are sitting on this Beit Din, on this court, and we're going to hear the testimony. So the Chazon Sofer says, you know what? That's a good claim. You're allowed to claim that as a Jew. A Jew is allowed to say, I don't want to go in front of this court to give testimony in front of them. But if they're judging him for something that's been claimed against him, he's not allowed to make that claim. When they're judging him, he has to go, and he has to be part of the, he has to be there for the judging they're doing him. And he said they didn't have to. So he says that's wrong. If you're in an accredited court, somebody's brought a claim against him, and or there's a claim that he's not keeping the Torah the right way, and therefore the court has to adjudicate it, the fact that he's greater than you does not change the fact that he's supposed to come if he wants to be there for the hearing of the testimony, to hear the testimony of the witnesses, to hear what the witnesses are saying about him. And he proves it by saying there's a, we know in the Gemara that a Kohen Gadol or a Nasi can get Malkot in a Beit Din. So the Nasi is the head of the Sanhedrin. The Kohen Gadol is the high priest. They are leaders of their time. So what court of three is going to give them Malkot? So the answer is, when it comes to judging people, if they've done something wrong, there, you need a qualified Beit Din. You need a competent Beit Din. But the claim, I'm a stronger Talmud Chacham, I'm a stronger Torah scholar than those people, is not a valid claim. Not only that, here, you didn't need a Beit Din. You didn't need a court to decide on something. The court's job in this case wasn't to rule on this rabbi situation. They were doing the messengership. They were fulfilling a mission given to them by the Gaon of Sentov, who was a local Torah scholar, who wanted to get the testimony together so they could decide as a larger matter. I mean, the Gaon of Sentov wanted to take the testimony, send it around to various rabbinim so they could help them decide. So remember, this is 1834. It's relatively the early days of reform. It's pretty clear to me that this rabbi is an early reformist, and he has various ideas and various practices that are going to become an issue, as we'll see in a minute. The Gaon of Sentov, this local rabbi, understands what's going on. He says, I'm not going to take it upon myself to try to fight this guy, but let's find out the information about the guy, and we'll send it around to the top Torah scholars of the generation, and everybody will decide together. That's relevant here, because that means that the court that's been set up doesn't have to claim to be great Torah scholars, because their job isn't to rule, their job isn't to decide, their job is just to get the testimony down on paper so it can be sent around to people, to great Torah scholars, who can then deliberate about it and decide what the best idea is to do about it, how best to handle the situation. And then the Chatzim Sofer points out that this rabbi showed his colors, as it were, by virtue of the fact that when they were calling him to court, he went to like local non-Jewish authorities, and he said the Chazor says the non-Jewish authorities, who are good people, they understood that it wasn't their place to be ruling on this issue, that is an issue that's supposed to go through local Jewish courts. Further, the accused made clear his lack of understanding of Torah law, because he says he wants the witnesses to swear, and he clearly doesn't realize that in Jewish law, witnesses don't take an oath. that if you need a witness to take an oath, that's a psul, actually. That actually tells you that the witness isn't a valid witness, because if you can't trust him on his own testimony by virtue of the fact that he's a Jew coming into court and saying, this is my testimony in court, so that itself is like a strong claim. For a Jew to say, I'm giving testimony, it's parallel to what it means to swear in a secular court, but that's not part of the Jewish system. So he says that's already a bad sign for this rabbi type in his understanding of the way halakha works. And now he says, let's look at the actual claims that have been made against him, the testimonies that have been brought against him. So the first is, he says there are three groups, the Chasam Sofer says. There are three groups of claims that have been made against this rabbi type. First is that he himself is not as observant as he should be. He eats without washing first. He doesn't bench after eating a meal. He talks between putting on his tefillin shel yad, his tefillin shel rosh. He eats meat after hard cheese and other things like this. Meaning these are all halachic problems, halachic issues. They're not tremendously terrible halakhic issues, but there are halakhic issues that everybody knows, everybody understands, and he doesn't care about them, and he's serving as a rabbi type. Let's remember that. So that's category one. Category two is that he leads others into sin. So for example, when it comes to animals, to kosher animals, after they're slaughtered, so there's this halakha called treifa. A treifa is an animal that has a physical wound that would cause it to die within a year. But we today don't check most of the types of treifa, most of the types of such wounds that can happen. We don't check for them. If we notice them, we would have a problem. But we don't check for them. But we do check the lungs. That's where the whole idea of glot comes from. Glot is that if the lungs are perfectly smooth, that's great. Sometimes the lungs have like things on them that could theoretically be a problem. Then you check them. Turns out they're not a problem. That's kosher, but it's not glot. That's where glot comes from. That's not our tshuva. But he was mekel on trephos in the lungs that he should have known, and on checking the blood vessels to see if the blood was all come out. He also was matir a woman to go to mikvah on day 7 of her count. Women, after they stop seeing blood when they're menstruating, and our custom, common practice is, the time of the Gemara is, that they wait for 7 full days where they don't see any blood whatsoever. On the 7th day, she's not supposed to go to mikvah. She's supposed to go to mikvah at night. So he allowed her to go to mikvah during the day. So that's, again, being mekel on halacha. But now, not only for himself, he's being mekel for other people in ways that halacha doesn't allow for, which means that they are going to be violating the Torah, violating halacha, even though they think they're not, because they think they got a ruling from him. Not only that, he makes it clear that he values it. He like boasts of the fact that he's such a big mekel, leading other people astray. And then the last one is that he says out loud and publicly that he doesn't believe in some things. He doesn't believe in retribution after death. He doesn't believe in what we call reward and punishment. Right, which turns him into an apikoros. An apikoros, in the technical meaning of the sense of, he rejects the words of Chazal, he rejects the opinions of Chazal, that's an apikoros. It makes him a min gamor. So he's really completely abandoned the belief and the faith system, the assertions of the underlying principles of the world, of the religion. And then you can't really talk to him, right? We're supposed to, again, we don't do this today, because we today tend to assume that everybody around us, even the ones who have abandoned religion, aren't real minyan. They're not really principled heretics. They just don't know what they're doing. But the original halacha was, and this is what topic that people have studied, like how in the 19th century these halachot became experienced in different ways, and there was change in how to deal with such people. But the original halacha in the Gemara, and that's what the Chasam Sofer is reflecting, is that you shouldn't talk to such people. And then, I'm sorry, there's a fourth, but it might be that he grouped what we just saw with being machshel the rabbi, with leading people astray, because he's announcing his belief. The third one is that, and here he says you don't need an edus for this, you didn't need testimony for it anyway, because it's just well known that he, in public, and begili panim, and like, and open faced, without any shame, arranged two gittin for two women in his city. So he wrote gittin in his city. His city wasn't a city with a tradition of how to write a get. Now, writing a get has a lot of technical issues to it. You'll name local rivers, you'll name the town, you'll name local rivers and other things that you'll name. And so writing that is complicated. So the Noda Behuda, actually, in the late 1700s, had said, you know what, we don't write get in any place where there's not a long-standing tradition. We don't think about new ways to write get in new places. So the Chasam says, we can't survive that way, because Jews are moving to too many places where there's no tradition whatsoever. You can't make them, if they need to get, go to someplace. Now, it happens to be years ago, I came across a tshuva by Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who wrote to Rav Henkin, who was his Rebbe, one is Rebbeim. He was the rabbi in Charleston, South Carolina at the time, and the only local play, the nearest place that people had a tradition was in Atlanta. So he wanted to know, how do you write a get in Charleston? And Rav Henkin tells him how to write a get in Charleston. They have to figure it out. Chazam's point is, therefore, we don't listen to Rebbe Yehuda and say, no. You can only go to places with a long-standing tradition. Chazam says, no, that's not true, but it's clearly true that if you're going to write a city's name, you have to check with people. You have to go to, like, important Torah scholars, the name of the city, the name of the local rivers, and how to use them. So, and it's never been true. Even the greatest Torah scholars, when they're writing again in a new place with no tradition, they consult with their friends to make sure that they're doing it the right way and that nobody complains they got it wrong. So this guy, it's very clear, he didn't ask anybody because he's that kind of an arrogant person and he doesn't care that much. He's both arrogant and he doesn't think it's important what he's doing to think that he has to worry about it. And based on that, actually, there was another local rabbi, a Rav Hagaon of Yarmouth, who said that these women have to treat themselves as married. They cannot rely on the fact that they received a get, which is always an interesting question. When women get a get or told by a Beit Din that they can marry somebody else, comes up in our time still. If that Beit Din is relying on certain leniencies or certain contested positions, the women, by some standards, might still be married, and therefore there's a whole issue. Now, so how do you deal with this guy? So the whole first category, his personal practices. So all of that is bad. And for all those things, he would theoretically need a nidui. He would need to be shunned and banned. So we do that in halacha. We used to do that. We don't do that anymore. But that's what should have happened. Although we say that when a rabbi type, a Torah scholar, requires nidui, we don't actually publicly announce a nidui. We tell him he needs nidui, and he's supposed to understand to treat himself as if he needs nidui. And this is especially true because he insulted, apparently, the Gaon of Sentov. They had some interaction, and he acted brazenly and arrogantly towards him and insultingly towards him. So he should know for himself that he needs to act with nidui so he can do the proper tshuva and whatever it is. But all of that, while it's true and important and necessary, that's not sufficient cause to remove this man from his position. Right, those are personal practices that are problematic. The fact that a rabbi has personal practices that are problematic, the Chassam Sofer says, that's not enough to take him out of his position, because that's his personal practice, which is, I think, astounding, right? If you knew that a shul rabbi today, an Orthodox rabbi, was, you know, not waiting between meat and milk at all, and I told you he just didn't care, right? Can you imagine the community would still keep him as the rabbi? So the Chassam Sofer is saying it's not good enough to get rid of him. That's a personal thing. Yes, it's true. There should be discipline applied to him, and other people should get involved and stop him from what he's doing, but that's not enough to get him out of his position. Now, in terms of the fact that he willingly and recklessly paskin for other people and didn't care, and that makes him into an apikoris, and the things that he said about Tzchar V'Onesh, that's for sure true, says the Chassam Sofer, that you can't listen to him in Torah anymore. He's not a Torah figure that you can rely upon anymore. But before you can decide it, you need two witnesses who are valid Torah witnesses who are not from this city. As soon as they're from this city, then they're what's called Nogin Ba'idutan. He's their rabbi, and they have a stake in whether he's going to be their rabbi or not, and therefore they can't count as witnesses, and therefore they can't bear the testimony. So unless you have testimony from other people that he said this, you're stuck, because it's true. The members of the community who know that this happened, or they're pretty sure that it happened, they believe the witnesses. That's a status in halacha. If a testimony isn't valid halachically, but if I believe it, I have to act as if it's true. That's called shavya nafshi chaticha disur. It becomes like prohibitive to me. Chatzim says the city's sort of stuck because they can't trust this man as their rabbi, but they also don't have enough evidence to get him out of his job. You know what they're going to have to do? They're going to have to hire a whole other guy and rely on that person to be their rabbinic leader, but this guy will stay in his job. Because unless they get testimony from outside people. And the Chassam Sofer says, but he does have to agree to do tshuva for everything that we heard about in the first edut. Meaning, is if he's just, if we come to him and say, we have testimony that says that you are violating these halachot, and you need to repent of that and change your ways, and then he says to the court telling him that, no, I don't want to. So then you won't need any more testimony, because that's itself going to be an example of him being brazen this way. Then we'll have evidence of it, and then you'll be able to get him out of his job, because for as long as he's doing this, he can't stay in the job, because an apikoris, somebody who's a heretic, somebody who mistreats halacha, somebody who mistreats rabbanim, is not somebody who can stay in a rabbinic job, and therefore you could get rid of him for those reasons, but only if he refused to do tshuva. But the last one, so I was so surprised, because the Chassam Sofer is saying the fact that we have real good reason to believe that he's no longer a believing Jew, I can't get him out of his job because I don't have halachically valid testimony, because that has to come from people outside of the city. But you know what really gets him? What loses him the job? The fact that he filled out those git, because he didn't have the right to write out git. And there you don't need testimony. Why do you need testimony? Because you got the document. And everybody knows who wrote the git and how mefor samim, says the Chatam Sofer, ain't tzarich raya. Things that are just completely well known, everybody knows it. You don't need a proof of that. And therefore, that along with all the things that he's done, so then you can get him out of the job. And then he adds, and by the way, it's not out of this job that you get him. Right? You defrock him, basically. You say he's not a rabbi who can be a rabbi in the Jewish people anymore. And they take him out, and they take out of his possession the certificates, the document that said he had the permission to be a Mori Horah, be a rabbi. And they had given him that before they knew the kind of person he was, and they got to get rid of that. And that's from the 13th of Tishrei of 1834. And that is, I think, a very interesting and applicable in some ways to today about what happens when a rabbi goes wrong and leaves his observance and leaves his connection and leaves his propriety as a rabbi. What you do with him, here are some ideas. So those are three tshuvot for the 13th of Tishrei, all of them surrounding issues of when people don't keep up with what they were supposed to. They don't fulfill their responsibilities. They don't fulfill their commitments. The Chatam Sofer for the 13th of Tishrei. Have a great day.